Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Back from Italy, which is why it's so interesting that Dr. Fabio Danisi joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from HealthQuest's Neuroscience Division in Kingston, where he specializes in movement disorders, Parkinson's disease, tics and tremors, and practices injection therapy for migraine sufferers. Dr. Danisi earned his medical degree from the University of La Sapienza in the School of Medicine. He completed his fellowship and residency at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, and he is also an avid motorcycle fan. Dr. Danisi, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to see you. You were born and raised in Italy.
Yes. Yes, I was.
Oh, that's great. Give us a call, everybody. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we're looking forward to hearing from you. Now, look, let me explain something. This is a neurologist, a first-rate neurologist, trained in Mount Sinai and knows all of the stuff. So, and if you have a question on neurology, now's the time to get on the phone. Let me tell you how it works. There are five phones. Two of them are already ringing. That means you have almost, there's three. See how fast it goes. You'll be out of luck if you don't do it now. All right, here we go. We'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, ask your question.
What neurological conditions might cause or simulate blindness?
Hi, Jim. Blindness from a neurological condition, in other words, blindness, a particularly placed stroke, and a stroke is basically when you... So if you happen to have a stroke involving a certain part of the brain, then you can have what we call cortical blindness. The eyes, if you shine a light in them, the pupils will constrict, will react to light, but the brain doesn't know how to interpret the signal that the retina sends to it, because that part of the brain is damaged by lack of circulation. So you can have blindness from a stroke. Likewise, you can have blindness in one eye for all sorts of reasons, multiple sclerosis. You can have blindness from a clogged artery to the retina, which is basically the equivalent of a stroke to the part of the eye that sees. And you can have blindness in very, very rare circumstances with some rare vitamin deficiencies that I, over 20 years, have never seen but have read about.
Yeah, mostly from the vitamin companies.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, let's go to Carolyn in Red Hook. Carolyn, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm here again.
Indeed.
Great to have a neuroscientist on. You're not a neurosurgeon, you're a neuroscientist?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, your questions, I see, were related to movement disorders, but I thought you might be familiar. There's information out, apparently, that there may be a correlation with long-term use of statins maybe being connected with some dementia forms. And the other question has to do more with cataract development for long-term use of antidepressants, but that may not be in your field, except that the antidepressants obviously are brain chemicals, in the brain, rather.
Right. Well, statins, first of all, for the most part, statins actually protect against dementia. That's because even with the kinds of dementia that are most common, like Alzheimer's disease, there is always a... or almost always, I should say, a vascular component.
Yeah.
And which means that there's almost always some degree of compromise of circulation through the little arteries that feed the brain with nutrients. And statins are well known to protect all parts of the body from clogged arteries.
Okay.
And so simply put, statins are known to reduce the risk of something that we call vascular dementia. Now, there are some scattered reports about statins being associated with some forgetfulness, and I know very little about this because it's not something that we normally concern ourselves about because it's such a rare incidence. But some people find that their memory actually declines when they take one of these drugs.
Yeah.
And the proof is in the pudding. If you stop the drug and you feel that memory is a little better, perhaps it's playing a role. We don't understand why that would be, though. Balance that, however, with the positive effects of statins in reducing the risk of heart attack, stroke, and clogged arteries elsewhere in the body.
Yeah.
And there's a well-proven risk of that. Now, of course, say somebody is really overweight and that person doesn't exercise and that person doesn't eat healthy, and then they're looking to statins to fix the problem, of course, you know, you're off track.
Yeah.
So the basics first, proper diet, proper exercise, healthy lifestyle comes first and foremost. And statins only help in those cases where you really aren't able to achieve good cholesterol control through common sense basic measures. I'm on statins. I've been on statins for a long time because ever since I was an intern, I found out that my cholesterol was sky high. I'm relatively thin. I was even thinner then. I would eat a pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, but then, you know, when you're 27 years old, you might do that anyway and not think twice about it. But I have a genetic form of high cholesterol, and there's no amount of exercise or keeping off the pasta that will keep the cholesterol down. And
it's so, proven genetic? There's a way to prove it?
Well, if you're young and you have high cholesterol and you don't have an exorbitant high-fat diet,
okay.
Then chances are it is genetically determined.
Carolyn, okay. Gotta let you go. A lot
now,
of people.
Now, what about the antidepressant aspect?
Oh,
Can you repeat that question? So, antidepressants and
that there seems to be a correlation between antidepressant use and an increasing increasing number of the population in their 30s, 40s, and 50s with cataracts.
I'm sorry. I really don't know much about that.
Me neither.
One. I've never heard that.
I've had two cataract operations, Carolyn, and I don't take antidepressants. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. Bye. Okay. Let's go to Virginia in Malta. Virginia.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi. My question is there anything that can be done about essential tremor?
Well, there's a lot that can be done about essential tremor. Now, essential tremor is a condition where you shake, and you shake when you go to grab something, you shake when you use your hands to do something, and it typically involves the hands and the head, sometimes the voice. Talking about genetics, essential tremor can be a genetic condition. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people that have essential tremor that run in families. When I was in training, I went to Ohio and saw four generations of people with essential tremor. There are old, tried and tested medicines that are effective in essential tremor, and they belong to different categories. One category is a blood pressure kind of medicine called a beta blocker. Another category is an old seizure medicine called a barbiturate. All of these drugs are quite effective for most people with essential tremor, but there are some that don't respond well. And I don't know if you've ever been on something like propranolol or mycelene, primidone, inderol, those drugs. So
no.
Those are the first-line treatment, assuming that the tremor is bad enough that it interferes with quality of life, because you don't want to treat something that doesn't interfere with quality of life. And that can be different for different people. So someone who is an actor or a trial lawyer, so if you're in the public eye, a little bit of shaking may interfere with your livelihood and your quality of life more so than if, I don't know, you're a copyright editor or something like that. So depending on what you need, if you need to treat the tremor, there are medicines. If medicines fail, then there's something called deep brain stimulation, which is quite effective. But that's only for severe tremor that has failed medicine.
Okay. Thanks, Virginia.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just seconds, so don't go anywhere. If you're in Barbara in Stone Ridge or Ron in Middletown or Grace in Sheffield or anybody else who has something to say, do it now.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing inpatient and outpatient care for New York's Capital Region. Reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, ellismedicine.org. Berkshire Choral International, performing Britain's War Requiem, Saturday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m., Route 41, Sheffield, Massachusetts, berkshirechoral.org. Hudson Valley Federal Credit Union, a local financial cooperative offering business checking, commercial loans, online banking, and more, hvfcu.org. The Olana Partnership presenting Exhibition Mystery Box Student Artists at Work through November 1st. Olana.org for details. Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio. And from Binghamton University's Watson School of Engineering, dedicated to preparing engineering and computer science students to meet the challenges of the future, binghamton.edu/Watson.
And we are back, and we are delighted that Dr. Fabio Danzi is with us today. A fantastic neurologist, Mount Sinai trained, just so wonderful to have you all with us. Let's go to Barbara of Stone Ridge. Barbara, you're on.
My question is regarding traumatic brain injury and actually acquired brain injury, and what your impression is of alternative therapies such as hyperbaric chamber, craniosacral, and fish oil. My sister suffered an injury in 2012. Unfortunately, it was so severe that, as is the case of many people in her condition, she did not last very long because they rush through the medical system where if they don't improve within a certain length of time, they're in a nursing home where they get very little, therapy. And I've met a lot of people in the meantime. Every 13 seconds, brain injury strikes. 400 New York residents every day. So I just wanted to know what your interpretation is on alternative therapies.
Great, Barbara. Thanks for that very good question. Doctor.
Barbara, sorry about your sister. Traumatic brain injury is very hard to treat. Part of the issue in science, in one of the most important things in science is not only knowing what you know, but also knowing what you don't know. And part of the difficulty we have with alternative therapies is that they are not necessarily supported by what we call the scientific method. In other words, you think something works, you put it through the rigors of scientific investigation, you see what the outcomes are, you compare those outcomes to other interventions, and you draw your conclusions. And when something is put through those rigors and it happens to be tree bark, well, hey, it might save a lot of lives, as does aspirin. Aspirin is tree bark. So there's nothing inherently alternative or about something that works or doesn't work. As far as I understand it, hyperbaric therapy has not been shown to alleviate signs or symptoms of traumatic brain injury. Frankly, very little other than intensive physical therapy makes a big difference. There are some medicines that might work a little bit, but due to the unfortunate nature of traumatic brain injury, there's a physical injury to this very delicate organ, and the physical injury leads to damage to nerve cells and damage to connections amongst nerve cells, and that is not simply that is not something. Remember, we have like 60 billion nerve cells in our brain. And those connections, once they're disconnected, they have to be reconnected. And it's not as simple as using certain oils or increasing the amount of oxygen in the brain. So unfortunately, we are still very, very far from being close to something effective.
Well, I see something. I agree with that in cases of my sister's who was severe. But I've seen many cases of injuries who are not quite as severe. And I know a lot of success stories with hyperbaric, and I'm learning a lot more. I've met people that have improved greatly with the fish oil. And my argument is, if it saves 1 out of 10 people, there's no harm to it. So why not continue to try it?
Well, there's absolutely no harm. The question is, and it has to be a question, would they have done equally as well with no intervention? In other words, would that have been their natural progression of recovery, because we can heal. The brain can partially heal. We all know that people recover after strokes or other forms of brain injury. And so all I'm saying is I don't know of any studies that have shown benefit. And that's when
and
you
again,
compare.
You have to continue therapy to know whether it's going to work. You can't give a time limit.
That may be entirely the case. That's correct, but we just don't know.
Hey, Barbara, thanks for the wonderful call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
You know, doctor, I just want to point out that if anybody wants to, if the phones are all busy and you want to get in, you could go to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. We have one free phone, and it's 1-800-348-2551. Okay, I do remember a study, because I used to take vitamin E all the time. I do remember a study that said it didn't work.
They did a large, what they call a meta-analysis. So they pooled the data from multiple studies, all of which individually didn't show any benefit or harm. And when they pooled all the data from all these studies and cranked out the numbers again, they saw that above 400 units of vitamin E, there was an increase in all-cause mortality. In other words, you're more likely to die on higher doses of vitamin E than not.
I remember. It's why I stopped. Okay, let's go
Glad you did.
Let's go to Ron in Middletown. Okay, Ron, you're on.
Hi, Doc. My question is, my dad is 80, and about 6 years ago he had a stroke. He had an aneurysm, but he recovered from it well. He actually still walks at 80 years old. My uncle at 72 died from an aneurysm, and he was very overweight. I'm 47. I do eat very well. I'm not overweight. I'm very physical. The only bad thing I do is on the weekend I'll go through maybe a case of beer, and I'll smoke like a pack of organic cigarettes. Other than that, my wife and I, we eat kale, nothing fattening. I come from one of those crews where it's, you know, I'm a party animal on the weekend. What do you think my chances are of having a stroke eventually? I don't get any pains in my head, or like, what advice can you give me?
Well, if you have two family members who have had aneurysms, I'd certainly talk to your doctor about looking into this a little bit more, especially
but
if there's...
blood pressure's not high either.
That's good.
It was 130 over 80 last time, and that was like a couple months ago.
The one thing that worries me is the fact that you smoke occasionally, because smoking is associated with increased risk of aneurysm rupture.
Right.
Apart from all the other things that can happen when you smoke, but specific to aneurysms, there's a higher risk of intracranial hemorrhage, what we call subarachnoid hemorrhage, from an aneurysm in people who smoke. We don't understand why, but that's definitely a clear link.
Probably because it raises the blood pressure, constricts the blood vessels.
No, it's what we call an independent risk factor. In other words, they look at things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity, this and that, and they do these fancy statistical analyses to eliminate what we call covariates. In other words, things that may go together, like being overweight or being having high blood pressure and smoking. No, cigarette smoking itself, for reasons that we don't really understand, independent of high blood pressure and other things, increases the risk of subarachnoid hemorrhage.
So, Ron, okay. I take it when you hang up, you won't be having any more cigarettes?
I think, you know what, I know that the beer thins the blood out, which is a good thing, so I should maybe like calm down on that a little bit and stop the smoking, huh?
Ron, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Doc.
Take care.
Let's go to Grace in Sheffield. Grace, you're on. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Grace in Sheffield. And you had the ad for Bertrand Coral Festival. I just want to say I usher for Bertrand Coral Festival. My cousins come and sing, and it's the highlight of my year. Okay. Now my question is, December 18th, 2012, I came down with a abscess tooth, like all in one day, and that night I realized, oh, I am sick. And every time I got up, it was like I felt a little sicker, and then about 5 o'clock in the morning, I got up and tried to get a drink of water, and, well, I found myself crashed. When I came to, I realized, oh, wait a minute, I gotta go, you know, sit down, and because the whole world went black when I was standing there. I mean, it was blacker than any black you've ever seen, and I know it wasn't something that, you know, I saw, and in the midst of the black was this ring of fire, maybe 7 inches in diameter, sort of like lightning. And then when I came to, my rib was hurting, and I realized I wasn't in bed. And and I passed out a couple more times before.
Okay, Grace, I'm sorry to cut you short.
But my question is, what I know it wasn't something I saw. What happened?
Well, it sounds like your blood pressure dropped quite a bit, and people are nauseous or feel sick when their blood pressure is low. I wonder if because of tooth abscess, maybe you weren't drinking enough or weren't eating enough.
Yeah.
And also, were you feeling at all dizzy or lightheaded when you'd stand up before this whole thing that we passed out?
No, just really, really sick. And, you know, I realized I was getting the fever. And
right.
I realized now I didn't drink enough water, but, you know, all of a sudden it was just black.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you had a drop in blood pressure. I hope you went to the emergency room or something like that after this happened.
Well, I crawled to the bathroom and drank 5 glasses of water and then crawled back in bed and then called the dentist in the morning. And
well, intuitively, you did the right thing by hydrating.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was low blood pressure, and that it can come in all shapes and forms. Low blood pressure can come with nausea without dizziness. It can come with visual darkening before you pass out, just because your brain isn't getting circulation, so it starts to shut down.
Yeah, I figured the brain just sort of shut off or something, because it's black with this ring of fire. Because, other people pass out, and I never hear them talking about this.
Grace, I thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much. Okay, let's go to Jane in Schenectady. Jane, you're on.
Hello, and thank you. I'm hoping for a little elaboration here. My mother died suddenly about 2 years ago, and after the autopsy, we weren't sure why she died. After the autopsy, it was determined that she had a stroke, or at least they guessed. And apparently, it looked as though the stroke had occurred 2 weeks prior to her death. So I'm wondering how that can occur. How could she never complained of having headaches. She was never sick. How could that happen? If you have any comment on that. I should also note that she did have multiple sclerosis, but that wasn't determined to be the cause of death.
Oh, wow. That the plot thickens. Okay. Well, sorry about your mom, by the way. And
thank you.
Strokes can sometimes be what we call silent. In other words, you can have a stroke, and if it happens to damage a part of the brain that doesn't cause that doesn't control certain parts of your body, you might have a relatively large stroke, but no obvious symptoms. And we see this sometimes. And sometimes we see people that come in with very subtle symptoms. We admit them to the hospital just to keep an eye on them. We do a scan, and we're surprised to see often the size of the stroke relative to the poverty, the lack of symptoms. So first of all, strokes can be silent. So if they thought, and second of all, you can't guess, if you're doing an autopsy, it's either there or it's not. You have a stroke, you see it on autopsy. There's no guessing. So what may have happened is whatever caused a stroke may have led to sudden death. For example, heart rhythm problems, something called atrial fibrillation, sometimes can throw off clots. And if you don't know that you have atrial fibrillation, you can have a clot going to the brain causing a stroke, possibly a silent stroke. But it can also cause sudden cardiac death because the heart goes into an arrhythmia, a rhythm problem, and you die possibly in your sleep.
And how can you tell that you have
atrial fibrillation?
Yeah.
Well, with atrial fibrillation, sometimes you tell because your blood pressure is low and you feel weak and you feel dizzy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you feel palpitations. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't feel a thing, but you go to the hospital for another reason. They do an EKG on you and they say, oh, my God, you have atrial fibrillation. And we see that. So there are all sorts of...
Can we fix that?
Oh, yes, we can. We can fix that with medicines. And if we can't fix the atrial fibrillation itself, we can at least limit the damage caused by the heart throwing these clots off and jamming smaller vessels upstream. So yes, we can and should aggressively intervene with atrial fibrillation.
Jane, any follow-up?
I was just going to say, so she may have felt the effects of this
AFib.
I mean, she just may have not thought it was something of concern, and because they did say that possibly she sat down, and when she was in a period of rest, perhaps drifting off to sleep, she died. Her heart just stopped. So it sounds like what you're saying.
Okay, Jane, I'm so sorry. We got five phones ringing off the hook. We want to give everybody a chance. Thank you so much
for
calling.
Thank
you,
Jane.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go to Nancy in Wilton. Nancy in Wilton, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband has relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. He's had it for over 20 years. He's in his mid-50s. The only drug he takes is statins, and then he takes Copaxone for the MS. He's been on that for a long time. The reason I'm calling is because he manages his MS very well. He can still walk. He has problems with his vision and his gait, heat intolerance, all those classic symptoms of MS. However, lately, what happened is that he's having cognitive problems. For instance, he'll start telling a story, and he'll get partway through, and then he'll just stop, and he'll just stare. Or we'll have a conversation, and then 5 minutes later, we'll say, now let's go do that, and he'll say, do what? Hmm. He has no memory of what we just talked about. Or he's a gardener, and this year, he came to me and said, how do I pick the lettuce? And I was just blown away. I was just like, oh, my God, what is happening to him? I've never gone to the doctor's appointment with him, and now I'm very, very concerned because he doesn't even know enough. When we talk about it, I said, you need to talk to them about what's going on with your cognitive abilities. And it's like it goes right over his head. He just doesn't understand what I'm talking about.
Okay, Nancy, I think we have the picture. Doctor?
Yeah, it's a great idea to go with the doctor, with your husband to the doctor's office. I can't tell you how often it's been studied that when people go to the doctor's office, a big chunk of what's exchanged, what's communicated is lost. My wife and I are both physicians. When we take our kids to the pediatrician, we walk out of there. I turn to my wife and say, what did she say? Do we need to give her antibiotics? And we're both physicians. So it's good to have anyway, forget cognitive impairment or not. It's a good idea to go with your husband to the neurologist every now and then. And with regards to cognitive impairment and multiple sclerosis, it can occur. It depends on what we call plaque burden, which is how many multiple sclerosis lesions are present. And that is something that may occur whether or not your husband experiences symptoms of MS relapse. So, you can have the relapsing remitting course like you were alluding to. And still, even though clinically there's no real change, there can be new plaques forming scattered through the brain, and that over time can slow down the brain function because these plaques, they basically eliminate the insulation that the nerves need, just like the plastic over an electrical wire. And so these nerves just don't communicate very quickly.
Making any advances with MS?
We're making enormous advances, fortunately. MS is one of the fields in neurology that's blossoming. We have new drugs for multiple sclerosis that are thought to be superior to what we call the platform drugs like Copaxone and the beta-cerons. And these are pills that you can take, and they tend to be very well tolerated. So definitely look into checking. I don't know if he's had a brain scan recently to see what the progression of multiple sclerosis is radiographically, as well as how he looks on examination. So that's the first thing. Make sure that cognitive decline is talked to with the doctor, because in this day and age, of course, we're rushed to see patients in very rapid fire fashion. And so, if you walk in and say, I'm fine, doc, everything's good. And men typically do that more than women, by the way. We tend to like, I'm fine. Then, the doc may not know to really dig deep into the cognitive aspect. And it's important to check for anything else that may be contributing to cognitive difficulties, be that circulation, be that vitamin deficiency, endocrine problems, obstructive sleep apnea, that interferes with quality of sleep because you don't breathe well and so you have cognitive difficulties. And say all of these things can contribute, and you have to check for all these things so that you can treat what's treatable.
Yep.
Nancy, got to let you go. Thank you
very much
for calling. Appreciate it. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back for our so-called lightning round.
Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York. Accepting new patients, NLH.org. Dorset Theater Festival presenting Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Jersey Lily in a Baker Street tale of intrigue and wit at the Dorset Playhouse through July 25th. DorsetTheaterFestival.org. FarmyMarket.com, an online farmer's market delivering local food from family-owned farms to homes in the capital region. FarmyMarket.com for orders. The Hotchkiss School, Lakeville, Connecticut, presenting the Summer Portals Piano Concert Series through July 26th, featuring Boris Berman, Olga Kern, Fabio, and Giselle Witkowski, HotchkissPortals.org. Berkshire Bank, providing banking, insurance, and wealth management with over 90 locations in New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Vermont. Berkshire Bank, America's most exciting bank, berkshirebank.com. And from Pioneer Post and Beam, designing and directing customized timber frame barns, artist studios, sheds, carriage houses, and garages, a non-kit post and beam builder serving the Pioneer Valley, Berkshires, and New England. PioneerPostandBeam.com.
And we are talking to Dr. Fabio Danzi, who is joining us today to respond to your questions. He's a fabulous neurologist. He comes to us from HealthQuest Neuroscience Division in Kingston, where he specializes in movement disorders, Parkinson's disease, tics and tremors, and practices injection therapy for migraine sufferers. Doc, this is our lightning round, and I'm going to ask you a couple that came in over the internet. I want to go real fast. What is the cause of pseudo-seizures? Can they be treated or reduced?
Pseudo-seizures are what we call psychogenic seizures. In other words, seizure-like events that are due to psychiatric issues. And they can be treated. They're very hard to treat. And they can be treated with talk therapy and psychotherapy and psychiatric care.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's a good one. Let's talk now to what is the newest best treatment for a spasmodic dysphonia?
Oh, something in my field. Excellent.
What is the current treatment for laryngeal dystonia?
Spasmodic dysphonia is a form of laryngeal dystonia. Dystonia is a movement disorder where the muscles contract involuntarily. And so your voice sounds strangled like that. It's a very tight, strangled voice. The best treatment thus far is still botulinum toxin injections, where you inject Botox or another form of botulinum toxin into the muscles that cause the vocal cords to spasm shut.
Interesting. And so there's a crossover between you and the ENT guys?
Exactly. In fact, a lot of movement disorders neurologists treat this, and a lot of ENT doctors that specialize in voice treat this.
Interesting. Thank you for that. That was great. Okay. Now, I'm a migraine sufferer. Could the doctor tell me about this injection therapy for migraines?
Well, it's botulinum toxin again. My subspecialty is not pain or migraines. It's movement disorders. I do a lot of Botox and other forms of botulinum toxin for dystonia. But they stumbled on the fact that botulinum toxin injections in 31 sites across the head and neck region reduces the severity and frequency of headaches in people.
How do you know where to inject?
There's a protocol that they took like 7 studies over 10 years to figure out. We don't know why it works. We don't know how it works. But the standardized one-size-fits-all protocol, where they tell you where basically to inject, it is quite effective in people who have very, very frequent headaches. So if you have a lot of headaches, several per week, you're definitely a good candidate for getting these injections, which are remarkably safe and well-tolerated.
And how is this new, or has this been around for a while?
This has been around. I've heard talk about this since the late 1990s when I was doing my fellowship in movement disorders. And when I came up to Kingston in the early 2000s, I had a lot of patients sent to me by my other neurology colleagues saying, Fabio, give it a try. Please try to treat my patient. But the FDA-approved version of this after the final study came out that finally showed good results was around 2008, 2009, I'm guessing.
That's great. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a lot of people on the phone, Jane and Dick and Kathy, Marie and Rachel. They're all waiting to talk to the doctor. So without yelling at me, I do get people who say, I wish I could have had more time. This is the end of the show, so I want to make sure everybody gets a chance. So we'll go as fast as we can. Let's go to Jane in Albany. Okay, Jane, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. About 6 years ago, I was diagnosed with a rare form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. 4 or 5 years before that, I had peripheral neuropathy that nobody could figure out what was causing it. Now they know that it's kind of a tag-along disease that goes along with the type of lymphoma that I have. Initially, it was just in my feet. Now, lately, it's in my fingertips, and my feet are definitely progressing. And I was wondering what, if anything, and when you would recommend some kind of intervention.
Well, the trick is to find out what the... So do you still have the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma under treatment?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the indolent forms that can go for quite a long time, and my oncologist is doing the watch and wait.
Well, the only two things you can do is, of course, obviously, treat the underlying cause, the lymphoma, and number two, check to see if there's anything else that may contribute to neuropathy. And there's a whole, slew of things that can do it, thyroid disease, diabetes, vitamin deficiency, and so forth, and eliminate those things because some of those things may be concomitantly causing damage to nerves. Vitamin B deficiency, very common. Thyroid disease.
Sure.
And so forth. Oh, and by the way, vitamin B6, taking too much vitamin B6 can cause damage to the nerves, among other things.
And so, what about Rituxan? That's one of the things the neurologist kind of held out to me in the beginning but said, I don't think we're going to do it now. Are you familiar with that drug?
Yes, but not very much. I really can't comment cogently about that.
Jane, thanks for a great call. Appreciate
it. Thank you. All righty.
Okay, let's go to Dick in Longmont. Okay, Dick, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm just thinking about the patient that has advanced Lyme disease who has facial paralysis. My question is, does the neurologist treat that patient, and what are some of the outcomes? How are the outcomes of these patients? Because a lot of times they have like a trigeminal neuralgia, tic de la rue, and I'm just curious to see what doctor will comment on that. Thank you.
Well, Lyme disease can go to the nervous system. It's well known. If it's a simple case of Bell's palsy or trigeminal neuralgia, usually treatment with pills, antibiotics, is sufficient. And remember that even after you treat the underlying condition for something like a Bell's palsy, that may persist because of the damage done to the nerve, even after the infection clears. If there are other signs that Lyme has spread to the brain itself and not the peripheral nerves or the cranial nerves, then you need a 28-day course of IV antibiotics.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Dick. Okay, let's go to Kathy in Newburg. Kathy, you're on.
Oh, thank you. I'm calling for my husband also. He has, he's 69 years old. He has high blood pressure that is treated. He is experiencing leg cramps severely that they wake him up in the middle of the night. He's wondering about getting further evaluation. The bottoms of his feet, he also is complaining of a burning sensation. And he typically, he's got good color in his feet. He's got no swelling, typically, good reflexes otherwise. And we're trying to figure out if, it's the next step for him to follow up with the neurologist.
Sounds like it. Does he have back pain?
Back
pain? But he has. Because one common cause of leg cramps is what we call spinal stenosis, where there's tightness in the spine and the lower back. Physically cramping the nerves.
He is very tight, yeah.
So that's one common cause. Another cause, does he get heebie-jeebies? Does he get restless in his sleep at night? Does he feel like he has to move so that the legs don't feel weird or uncomfortable?
I would say yes.
Because restless legs can give you nocturnal leg cramps as well. So there are all sorts of reasons, and they are neurological, that you can have leg cramps. And burning sensation in the feet is typically neuropathy. So as I was saying before, you can have neuropathy from very many different reasons. Or the burning feet can be due to pinched nerves as they try to exit the spine to go to the legs. So it's either a mechanical problem or a neuropathic problem.
Kathy, I'm so sorry to give you such a rush, but we really want to get to everybody. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Bye. Let's go to Marie in Lake George. Okay, Marie.
Hello. About 3 months ago when I was gardening, I fell over and bumped my forehead. Since then, everything that's white is so blaring white that I can't stand it. I have to wear sunglasses for television, reading the paper. So I went to eye doctors, nothing. I went to my, I have macular degeneration, so I went to my retinal specialist, and he gave me the best examination he could get. He said, Marie, there's nothing wrong with your eyes. So then I went to the next step of a CAT scan.
No, that's not going to be helpful. Do you ever get, when you were young, like in your teens or your 20s, did you ever get migraines?
No, I never did.
I've never got headaches?
I've never had a headache in my life. And I went to a neurologist last mm-hmm. Thursday, and he's after the examination, he said, Marie, I've been a neurologist for many, many years, and I have never seen anything like it in my life. He said, I can't treat you because I don't know what this is. I don't know what it is. I've never seen anything like it.
Nor have I heard of anything like it, unfortunately.
No, and every doctor I talk to says the same thing.
Now, if you had headaches, I tell you it's a migraine equivalent. But with no history of headaches, got me.
No.
Hey, Marie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it a lot. Okay, let's go to Rachel in Gardner. Rachel, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to recommend for the woman whose husband was having the difficulties, there's a book by a neurologist, Dr. David Perlmutter, called The Better Brain Book. And he describes, he talks about statins and which statins can be difficult for the brain and what you need, and all kinds of medications, and what you need to take if you're having difficulties and how to judge how far it's gone. So it's called The Better Brain Book by David Perlmutter, and everybody I've given the book to has thanked me when they've had situations. So,
Rachel, thank you for calling. Appreciate that very much. Good information. Let's go to Jenny in New Marlboro. Jenny, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling. I have a friend who's in a bit of a tricky situation. So she's in her mid-20s now, and when she was around 7 years old, she was sexually abused, and she also fell off a building and fractured her skull and had a traumatic brain injury. Now she's in her mid-20s, dealing with the past trauma, has horrible OCD and a traumatic brain injury and fibromyalgia. I know she's seeing a pretty good therapist, but she just doesn't know kind of what to do first and how to proceed. How do we deal with this level of a brain injury kind of from all fronts?
Well, therapy is the first place. I agree. And then sometimes OCD can be treated pharmacologically with medicines.
Okay, and OCD, once again, is?
Obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Right.
When people have to do things just right, and it really interferes with everything you do. It's those kids that can't finish an SAT test because they have to circle in the little circles perfectly. Otherwise, they freak out. So OCD is very disabling, and that can potentially be treated with medicine. Traumatic brain injury, as you've heard before, we don't have good options for, unfortunately. The therapist is really where you would go first. A neurologist would certainly take second place in treating this kind of condition.
Okay,
thank you so much.
And thank you. Let's go to Janet in Lake Katrine. Okay, Janet, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Denise. I just want you to know that I had a massive brain tumor that your lovely Dr. Tamai discovered for me, and it was removed in 2009 at NYU. And in the meantime, I've been going to a ton of therapies like cranial sacral, neurofeedback, reflexology, tons and tons of things that have helped me calm down, get better behavior, and try to just get better, healthier. And I just need help with figuring out how we can help. I refer to the politicians up in Albany as mucky mucks because I can't remember all their titles. But we need help. There's a group of us that need help to convince everybody in the medical profession and all the mucky mucks in Albany that this stuff has got to be covered by insurance because it's helping so many people. There's also hyperbaric chamber stuff that I've never personally done, but I've heard wonderful things about by other people with brain injuries. So I just say, how do we proceed? Because we need your help.
Well, that's a loaded question because financing of medical treatment in this country is an issue that we can spend hours on and not come to any reasonable resolution. As I said before, I think the first question of the day was about alternative treatments to traumatic brain injury. Part of the difficulty is there are so many obstacles to treating these conditions. And part of the difficulty is that we don't have that many studies that have conclusively shown benefit. And if given a chance, not to cover something, an insurance company won't. And this is a perfect case in point. Since we have lack of data, the insurance company won't cover something that mm-hmm. doesn't have solid data to support its use. And
right.
and that's first and foremost a scientific problem, one of finding something that is conclusively effective, and then it becomes a political slash finance problem.
Sure.
But the first and foremost, it's finding something that actually not only we think works and we see that works in other people, but is proven to work. And these are two very different things.
Well, Janet, thank you very much. Let's go to Eva in Little Falls. Eva.
Hi. My boyfriend is suffering from peripheral neuropathy, most specifically foot numbness and tingling. And before he was diagnosed with that, he had 12 weeks of hepatitis C treatment successfully. He has been prescribed Lyrica. I wondered if you could talk a little bit just about the causes, treatments, and recommendations for peripheral neuropathy.
Well, peripheral neuropathy can be due to a ton of things, including diabetes and some other things that I mentioned before. Hepatitis can cause neuropathy and is one cause for peripheral neuropathy. And Lyrica is pregabalin. It's a medicine that's been shown to be effective in treating peripheral neuropathy. But neuropathy is damage to the nerve endings.
Thank you, Eva. Okay, let's go to Bob in Glens Falls. Bob, keep it short.
Hello, I have a question on a neurology type issue with my hands. I have trouble making a fist and trouble gripping things.
Both hands?
Yes.
And it's just weakness in the hands, but not weakness, for example, in other muscle groups?
Correct.
Do you get any neck pain?
No.
Are you slowing down? Are you slow or stiff? Do you walk slowly? Have you noticed that lately?
I probably do walk slowly.
Yeah, ultimately, this could be a lot of things. It could be pinched nerves from your neck, or it could be other things, but you should get it checked out by a neurologist, because I'll bet a quick examination will tell you what's going on.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, very quickly, if you can make it quick, Mary, I think we can get you in. Mary from Rhinebeck, your turn.
Yes, doctor. I just wanted to ask the question of what does it mean when you're sitting, whether you're reading or watching TV, and you can hear your heartbeat?
It means nothing. It's called pulsatile tinnitus, and it's totally benign.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure. Well, that was good. Mary, thank you very much. Therefore, we might be able to get Henry in. If you can do just as well, Henry, this is going to be the last call. Go ahead.
Yeah, my wife has had shingles, and her two brothers, triplet brothers, got over them. She has lost the nerve feeling on her right cheek.
Okay, that's where she had shingles? Well, shingles is a virus that, herpes zoster virus is a virus that goes to nerve endings. And so when you have that virus infection into the nerve, it can actually damage it to the point where it won't work, hence the numbness.
Okay, I'm sorry, Henry. We are out of time. Appreciate your call. Okay, so thank you, everybody who called in, and thanks to all of you who have tried to get to us today but couldn't make it. I'd also like to thank Dr. Fabio Danisi for joining us today. He was terrific, as you heard. Got to have him back. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Well, Doctor, once again, I want to thank you for being here and for all those people who have been so good to bringing you here to us. Stay tuned now, everybody, for a news update.